Welcome to The Manifest, a podcast all about package management. My name's Andrew Nesbitt.
And I'm Alex Pounds.
And together, we're talking with folk from around the world of package management. We're exploring the technical details, hearing the stories and the history of different projects, and learning about the communities behind them too.
Today, we're joined by Daniel Compton, who's a volunteer maintainer of CloJars, the Clojure Community Maven Repository. He's also building Depths, a private Maven repository service. Daniel, welcome to The Manifest.
Thanks for having me.
So Daniel, you're very involved in the Clojure world these days, but Clojure's a little bit of a niche language. So what was your path to Clojure? How did you find yourself working in this ecosystem?
So I was working as a consultant for on an ERP product that's short for Enterprise Resource Planning. And so that's warehousing, finance, sales, shipping, all of that sort of businessy warehousing stuff, and that used a mutable SQL Server database, and even the code that ran it all lived in the database. So I was working kind of daily with these big ginormous mutable databases, and I would occasionally need to, someone would make a change or break something, and I would need to figure out what did they do and how do I fix it. And this was a pain when you've just got stuff mutating in place, you need to go restore a backup or find some other way of figuring out what that value used to be in the database row. So I was watching a talk from Rich Hickey, who created Clojure, and he was talking about Datomic, which is a database that he created, and it's an immutable database where you accrete facts over time. You never mutate in place. If you're item description today was pack of sponges, and then someone came in tomorrow and changed it to pack of spawn, you could look back in time and see what it used to be, who made the change, when did they make the change, all of that sort of interesting metadata that you often want to know about changes in your system. And I thought, man, that would be, wish I had that. That would just be so amazing for my day job. And of course, there was no way I was ever going to get to use that. I sort of thought, this guy seems to be pretty onto it. And so I started watching some talks of his about Clojure and thought, I really like this language. And so I sort of started just working, this was still in my spare time. I was just learning the language and tinkering away with it. And then eventually I left that consultancy and started working full-time as a independent consultant and mostly working with Clojure and ClojureScript.
So were you using Java or some other JVM-based language before, or was it something completely different?
Something very different. So the system I was using was called Microsoft Dynamics NAV, which you'll probably have never heard of, and it was that the programming language that it used was called CAL, which is like a Pascal-based derivative from like 1980, 1990. Like they kind of just forked it off there, and it was a pretty primitive programming environment. You had very limited control over what you could do, and they'd got syntax highlighting in about 2008. That was the big headlining feature at that point. So, this is not Visual Studio or IntelliJ.
And I know we're here to talk about Clojars, but did Dynamic AV have any package management?
The way that you had to manage the code with this was all of the code that was running lived in the database. And so when you compiled it in your development system, and then you would export these compiled objects out and then go over to the customer's site and import them. And there was very little package sharing. It was even difficult within our company to share it, because the way Dynamics NAV works is that you have to license to get custom objects or forms or tables. You have to pay some money to Microsoft to kind of get a license for that, and those licenses are tied to an integer range. So you say, I want my license to allow me 60,000 to 60,050. And all of the objects kind of under the covers work with these integer references. So if you've got a customer who's got something at 60,000 and you've got another customer who's got something at 60,000, which are different objects, then you can't just kind of export one out and do it with the other, because you're going to clash with it. So it was very labor intensive if you ever wanted to share something amongst multiple people within your company, and you basically would never do it in an open source way because it was just so difficult and the culture just wasn't there.
So Datomic led you to closure and your first kind of explorations of the language, but once it had piqued your interest, how did you get from there to helping maintain closures?
So I was working on closure open source projects. I found that a really good way to work on my skills and learn the language better and learn the styles and ways of programming with closure. And Clojars is an open source project and they have issues on GitHub, so I had worked on them a bit, and then I worked on them some more, and Toby Crawley asked me if I'd like to join up as another maintainer of Clojars.
And for anyone who's not had a chance to look at Clojure, could you give us a quick summary of what the language is, where it came from, and why it's particularly interesting?
So Clojure is a dynamically typed Lisp. It's a functional programming language. It runs on the JVM, and it has a strong emphasis on immutable data structures. So probably the biggest feature of those would be the immutable data structures. That's the one that tends to be the most important in practice. And when you talk to people about Clojure and they say, you know, if you're going to go use another language and you could take one thing from Clojure, what would it be? Most of the time people say immutable data structures, because they just solve so many problems with concurrency and mutations and building robust systems.
Do you have an example of that?
Yeah. So Clojure's data structures being immutable means that if you have a reference to a Clojure map, let's say, and you add a new key to it, then the old reference to the map before you added the key will still always have, you know, that map without the key, and you adding the key returns a new reference, and that new reference includes the key. And so you can have many threads working on data and doing different things to it without ever having their changes clobbering each other. So it's really good for kind of parallel processing of things, because you don't need to worry about, you know, other threads stepping on your toes.
So the Clojure community, I guess, started using Maven as it was built on the JVM. You always had some kind of package manager available. How did the Clojures repository come about?
So this is well before my time even using Clojure, but kind of my understanding and looking through the history of things is that there were a few programmers who, you know, were using Clojure, and this was, I think it was about 2010 or so, and they, you know, Maven Central has some restrictions on the way that they kind of want you to publish your packages, and these programmers wanted something with a bit more flexibility, so they worked and came up with Clojures, which is the open source Clojure package manager.
So how does Clojures differ from Maven Central?
So the main difference between Clojures and Maven Central is how it is a bit more permissive in what it lets you upload and how it lets you do so. So to contrast that, Maven Central, who you had Brian Fox on here a few episodes ago talking about Maven Central, it requires you to open up a ticket in Jira if you want to, you know, start a new artifact in the Maven repository, and that goes through a few basic checks, and they check, you know, you're not obviously a spammer and so on, and then they you know, they approve you, and then you can, you know, start deploying. Clojures is much more permissive in that when you deploy an artifact, if the group and version doesn't exist, then it's created and you become the owner of that group and artifact name.
So you're mirroring the kind of behavior of Maven, but is the implementation kind of a completely from scratch?
Yes, I mean, we use some of the Maven libraries under the covers for things like parsing the POM files and doing the sort of dependency analysis, but the kind of implementation of the repository and how it handles the uploads is custom.
And that's written in Clojure, I guess, rather than in Java?
That's right, yeah.
So if I'm a Clojure programmer and I want to pull in some packages from Clojars, what does that process look like? How do I actually use Clojars?
Sure. So the main Clojure build tools, Linogan and Boot, have built into them Clojars and Maven Central as two default repositories. So you know, if you're just turning up and you want to download some package that's deployed on Clojars, you just type in that dependency coordinates into your build file, and when you sort of ask for your dependencies, they will know to go out to, well, they'll check Clojars and Maven Central, and Clojars will respond with the dependencies. If you're using Maven or another JVM build tool that isn't isn't Clojure specific, they probably won't have Clojars loaded as a default repository, and so you can add different repositories into your Maven config, and so you add repo.clojars.org, and that will tell your tool to go ask Clojars for these different files.
Have you found that anyone had tried to use Clojars for hosting their Java projects? As you say, it's much more permissive, there's no restrictions.
I don't know. I don't know of anyone doing it. And probably the main reason why you wouldn't want to do that if you're a Java programmer is that the kind of the culture in the JVM community, and Maven in particular, is you don't want to be adding extra repositories to your project file if you can help it, because that kind of adds, there's a bunch of implications to that. And so if you were publishing your project and you were to tell people, oh, you need to add in this weirdo Clojars repository to use my project, they would probably just say, we'll deploy it to Maven Central so I can use it. And yeah, so that, but you know, if someone wants to do that, it's totally fine by us.
Do you get the impression that most Clojure developers are entirely using Clojars or entirely using Maven, or is it usual to have a mix of both in a project?
It would be usual to have a mix of both. Clojure itself is deployed to Maven Central, and there's a number of Clojure libraries that were perhaps started before Clojars, or they wanted to be able to get wider reach of their projects, so they deploy them to Maven Central. And then, you know, of course, many of the projects in the Clojure community are on Clojars.
So Linogan is, at least from my experience, the kind of the main tool people using to manage their dependencies in Clojure, as well as a lot of other Clojure build related things. I've not heard of Boot before. Is that quite a new project?
Yeah, Boot's been around for maybe 4 or 5 years, but it's only really started to take off in the last year or two. And the main difference between Linogan and Boot is that Linogan strives to be a more declarative project configuration, where you have essentially a map of your config, whereas Boot is your configuration file for Boot is an executable Clojure file, and you define your tasks in there as Clojure functions.
The good old Turing complete manifest file.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that there's pros and cons to both, as I'm sure you're very well aware running libraries IO, because you, I guess, have to, you get the whole range of...
Yeah, I'm definitely not going to be jumping at the chance to implement a Boot parser, given that it is executable Clojure. I mean, it's hard enough. We run a small service written by a friend of mine called Tom Hall that can parse the Clojure, is it project.clj?
That's right.
Which is the Linogan definition. Luckily, not really executable, but you need a Lisp to be able to interpret that properly with all the nested dependencies and things like that. So there's a little Clojure service we have that we can feed to one of these files and get back a JSON representation. And that's already kind of scary, because I have no idea how to edit this Clojure project, or it runs inside a Docker, so I don't really need to think about it too much, but occasionally the JVM will eat all of RAM on the machine, and it's a bit of a headache to run, but at least I know I'm not executing arbitrary code downloaded from the Clojure community.
Yeah, well, I'm sure Tom Hall's done this, but the Linogan Project CLJ is, let's say, it's kind of executable, in that if you were to read it and understand it fully, you would need to execute code to do so. But you can do a pretty good job of passing it without actually needing to. You know, you can read the file safely, and that's something I do on one of the projects I run. But you don't get the full, you know, there's things that people can do that you aren't able to understand without actually executing it.
Yeah, I guess you can also bring in, because it is still a Clojure file, you can bring in other contexts and expand the definition of what that file does if you'd like. But then one of those kind of, I guess Clojure has the idea of code as data, which works out really well in this case.
Yeah.
So Andrew attributes that code as data property to Clojure, but I think that's pretty much true of all Lisps. And you also mentioned that there's immutability is kind of a big deal in Clojure. Do those two features have any impact on package management?
So the immutability doesn't impact us directly, although I guess the culture of immutability is a strong influence on us and how we design and run the package manager. Clojure being a Lisp and the code as data thing doesn't make it more difficult for us to do certain kinds of things that you might want to do with your Clojure projects. Because to understand your Clojure projects, even the build file, but also the source code, you need to, you know, to understand it fully, you need to evaluate it, which requires, you know, executing arbitrary code. That's kind of difficult to do some of the things that you might want to do with it.
So how do you get around that?
You know, so a concrete example of this is building auto-generated documentation. That's something that, you know, a couple of communities do, and it's a pretty cool thing to have for your projects. But up until recently, no one's really wanted to tackle this problem in a sort of automated way, taking arbitrary code that anyone can upload, because of, you know, it's just kind of difficult to be able to do that safely. So 5 years ago, that would have been very tricky to do safely, because, you know, to do that, you'd have to be running it on your VM, and, you know, maybe you would have disposable VMs, but they take a long time to start up and shut down and stuff, and so it just would have been kind of a non-starter back then. More recently with Docker, it's a little bit more feasible to kind of think about running, you know, evaluating people's code to auto-generate documentation for them. And there's a project that a guy, Martin Klepsch, is working on called CLJ Doc, which hopes to do this. And so I think he's going to use AWS Lambda and Docker containers and things like that to be able to generate documentation for projects in a safe manner.
Alternative name for that could be Read the Jars.
I like that.
I've looked into the whole generate documentation from source code a number of times over the past couple of years, and most times just kind of backed away slowly, as it seems like you can get a reasonable way in some languages, and some other languages it gets very hairy very quickly to be able to kind of generate the like list of method signatures, classes, modules, and actually output those in some kind of standard format that is shared across multiple different things. Everyone seems to build their own kind of thing, and there's no real form of like translation between these. We don't have like the standardized docs across languages. Everyone is different in a different interesting way.
Yes.
I was wondering if you and kind of your work on Clojures has led you down a path of trying to fix or change the behavior of kind of the standard Maven way of doing things, where Maven is kind of very fixed in the way that it works. Have you been able to change its behavior because you're kind of building on top of it, but have a little bit more flexibility in how you do that?
Not particularly. I think so far, and we can talk a little bit more about this new tool from the Clojure core team, which kind of tackles this. But kind of historically, Clojures and kind of the Clojure community has been more or less happy to kind of follow the Maven way of doing things using the Maven dependency resolver, Ether, I think it's called. And I have, you know, high praise for Maven. I think it's done a really they've done a really great job in designing a protocol and package manager, and you know, people have complaints about it, but you know, the dependency resolution part of it, I think they've done a really great job. And I guess you can see that because the way that they've worked on it, yeah, Brian Fox was talking about how it's so difficult to change things with it because it's so widely established. But I think it's a credit to them that they've managed to build this system that is used by so many different projects and different kinds of package managers, and you know, it mostly works for all of them.
Thinking about it under the hood, when Linegan is publishing something out to the Clojures repository or the Maven Central repository, it's going to be generating all of that kind of structure and the metadata files for you, rather than you writing your own pom.xml. It's going to be creating that based off your project.clj.
That's right, yeah. And that's what we use in Clojures, because the pom file is an XML file that isn't executable, you know, or at least, you know, we read it in a non-executable way, that, you know, we can introspect that a lot more easily than we could, you know, a project CLJ file.
Out of interest, do you know if Maven, and I guess by extension Clojures, insists that packages are immutable? Once you've published a version at a particular version number, you can't go in and update / replace that version?
Yeah, that's a great question, and both Maven Central and Clojures don't allow updating existing deployed versions. The one exception there is that the Maven protocol allows a thing called a snapshot version, and so you can say, you know, my project is 1.0.0-snapshot, and then whenever you try and deploy that snapshot version, it will kind of update in place what's on the server. It doesn't overwrite in place, it kind of adds a new snapshot version to that, and then when your Maven tool goes to look for that snapshot version, it will always pick the latest. But that's kind of the one exception. And you know, we get this is definitely by far the biggest maintenance I wouldn't say it's a problem for us, but it's the largest maintenance request for us, is people wanting to delete their projects from Clojures. And yeah, this, so our kind of number one philosophy with Clojures is don't break the build. And so we, you know, very strict about, you know, there's no kind of user, no way that a user can just go in and unpublish or remove their code. Once it's up, you know, they don't have any update or delete controls over those packages that they've published. But you know, sometimes people will want to delete the projects, and there's different reasons for them. Sometimes kind of the main reasons that we would delete something is if it was malicious, if it contained copyrighted code or copyrighted you know, other material. We have a upload size limit on Clojures, but say someone wanted to kind of upload the new Iron Man movie in a jar file or something, you know, we would take that down.
Jar man.
Yeah. And the other one is that if someone has accidentally deployed their company private code or private credentials to Clojures, then you know, we would take that down. But we get people asking, you know, I don't like this project anymore, or you know, I picked the wrong name for it, or I'm no longer using Clojure, I want to take it down. And you know, to those we will, you know, almost always say no, because we don't, you know, other people rely on Clojures to be immutable, and particularly that for it to be kind of accretive. So you know, there's always stuff being added to it, but never taking away. We've talked a little bit about this recently, and I think we're going to soften the policy slightly that sort of within the first 24 hours of someone publishing a version, if it's like, you know, no one's ever downloaded it, they're working on an open source project that they want to be open source, but they had a typo in the artifact name, we would allow that. But, you know, for anything more established, we would probably say no. And in some degrees, we've brought this on ourselves, and that we allow kind of open deployment, and people can just push whatever they want. And so that definitely has costs to us, has cost to the community. And one thing that it has cost on is actually the entire Maven community, because the way the Maven repositories work is that if you have, let's say, Maven Central and Clojars in your repository config, then when you go to download a file, Linogan doesn't know where to download this file from. They just know, here's a bunch of places that I can go looking for that file. And so it will just start with the first one in the list and ask it for that file. And if it gets a 404, then it will go to the next one and the next one and so on. And so that means that there's kind of a global namespace, not just Maven Central, but kind of Clojars and any other Java package managers. They all kind of exist at some level within the same namespace. That has some problems and some security risks. So, for example, someone malicious could deploy to Clojars, say the Netty jar. Netty is very popular, and it's published to Maven Central. But if you know, you could take Netty and modify it, put some bad code in there, and publish that to Clojars under the same group and artifact and version, and which one Clojure users get would be kind of a little bit luck of the draw. And so when we realized this, this was kind of around the time that typo squatting was starting to become more widely known. When we realized this, we thought, yeah, this is not a good thing to have. So we now check on new deploys of, you know, a new artifact for the first time. Does this artifact already live on Maven Central? So we prevent shadowing there.
That sounds like a very reasonable thing to do, especially as you were saying, I was like, oh, I can think of all kinds of ways to abuse this.
Yeah. And one thing that people don't probably don't realize, if you're using a Maven repository and you use an internal Maven repository, and we see this in the logs, is that people's internal projects, depending on how they've kind of configured their systems, the queries for those artifacts and versions come out to Clojars and presumably Maven Central as well. So, you know, if someone was being malicious, you know, they could publish an artifact that belonged, you know, if they in a targeted attack, they could publish an artifact that belonged to, you know, some bank or something that had their own internal jars, and they're, depending on how their tools work, they might download the version off Clojars instead of their own internal one. So that's something to just keep in mind when you're publishing things, and quite a good argument for why you might want to have a Maven repository or a Maven firewall that sits between you and the rest of the internet.
So you actually end up having quite a lot of responsibility by accident of just being a popular alternative Maven repository.
Yeah, we do. And so we also, oftentimes people running these internal Maven repositories will configure Clojars. So you're running a Nexus or a JFrog, someone in the company might want something off Clojars, so they will add Clojars as a repository to their config. And that now means, you know, Clojars needs to be as secure as Maven Central, because, you know, it's a big responsibility. And it's something that I didn't really kind of fully grasp until I started sort of, we were doing some log analysis because we're getting a lot of traffic, and we were trying to figure out, you know, is any of this not necessarily malicious, but just, you know, accidentally using, you know, they've misconfigured things. That's when I kind of realized the full magnitude of, this, you know, this is actually a pretty wide blast radius for Clojars. It's not necessarily just the Clojure community, but probably quite a large part of the Java community would be impacted as well.
Blast radius is the best description of package management security I've ever heard.
So you mentioned the private Maven repositories that companies can run, and I want to return to that one in a second. But how big is the Clojars project and the Clojars community? How many packages do you have? How much traffic does it get? How big is it?
Sure. So we have, in terms of package, the kind of the total repository, you know, the sum total of all of the things that have ever been uploaded to it, it's around about, I think it's between 60 and 80 gigabytes, which is, you know, pretty small. And we do about, I haven't looked at the stats super recently, but about a terabyte to a terabyte and a half of downloads a month, depending on, you know, the month. There's about between, say, 10 and 20,000 Clojure programmers, and it's pretty hard to use Clojure without using Clojars at some point. So, you know, pretty much all of them are users of ours. They're not all deploying to us, but, you know, they're all downloading from us.
What are the most popular Clojure packages?
So the most popular Clojure package is a project called CLJ HTTP, which is kind of the de facto standard Clojure HTTP client, which many projects, you know, use directly, but also it's often the substrate for other projects, like, say, a Stripe wrapper or any kind of API client will probably try and use CLJ HTTP as their HTTP transport. The other big ones are Ring. Ring's the sort of Clojure web framework. You can kind of think of it as sort of akin to Ruby's Rack. Like, it's the protocol and contract for different HTTP based frameworks to send and receive HTTP responses. Composure, which is a routing library, and CLJ Time, which is a time, you know, time calculation library.
I guess you also have Clojure and Linegan on Clojars.
Yes, Linegan is a little bit further down the list, and Clojure is on Maven Central, so we don't see those numbers. I'd be very interested to see what the download stats are for Clojure, but there, as far as I know, Maven Central only gives the package maintainers access to their own download stats. I don't think just anybody can look at the download figures.
Yeah, that's definitely a thing. I have completely avoided the slightly hairy subject of download counts on libraries.io. A number of people have asked for it, mostly from the Node community, where npm makes a big deal of their download counts. But many other package managers don't necessarily have a good idea of what the download counts are, either because they're heavily cached by CDNs or that their clients are actually very aggressively caching things, and so once you've downloaded it once, you might not download it again, because once it's on your computer or once it's in your compiled into your application or vended in, that you may not see it be downloaded again on a regular basis. Or you're just using GitHub as your repository, and then they have a similar download tracking setup where you can only see download stats if you are a owner or you have the commit bit for that particular repository.
Yeah. I just should mention that Clojars moved to a CDN about a year or 2 years ago now, and that's sponsored by Fastly, and Rackspace provides the object storage that backs that repository. They're the ones now footing the bill for that traffic, which, you know, it's not huge, I'm sure, to Fastly, but, you know, it was starting to become pretty big for us. And so, yeah, we really appreciate them both for sponsoring Clojars.
Do you get any support from Oracle? Or I think Oracle is still in charge of Java, right? Like, Oracle still kind of owns it.
Yeah, yeah.
Do they give any support for Clojars at all?
Not to my knowledge. Oracle, you know, I do see occasionally people from Oracle show up on the Linegan issue tracker with Java 9 and the new modules stuff, and there's a few changes to how Java works. You know, they were sort of helping out and giving us some advice there. So, you know, I would say Java is probably on a more open trajectory rather than a more closed trajectory at the moment. The OpenJDK, I'm not sort of really steeped in this, but historically there's many different JDK implementations. You know, IBM does one, so there's some proprietary ones, and Oracle makes the most popular one. And there's been this project called OpenJDK, which is it's kind of Oracle's JDK, but missing a few proprietary things. And for a long time, that was sort of seen as not production ready, or it wasn't kind of certified by anybody as being something that you could use. But more recently, Oracle are making moves to kind of shore that up and make that more of a kind of safe choice, that you could use OpenJDK and be kind of pretty comfortable that it's going to work with everything. And they're also open sourcing more and more of their tools. So, I mean, I feel a bit weird being an Oracle apologist here, because, you know, clearly there's lots of things that they do that aren't that great. But as far as Java's going, I guess I would give them probably one thumb up, two thumbs up, one and a half thumbs up.
Yeah, that sounds pretty reasonable. Not being from in deeply embedded in the Java community, I don't really see what goes on internally. I just see Oracle's lawsuits with Google.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other side of things that is not so great. But also, Oracle is continuing to invest a lot in Java, and there's a bunch of really cool projects that they're working on, like a pauseless, or, you know, very very low pause time garbage collector, different improvements to the language. They've added a new versioning scheme to Java where they're doing much more frequent releases now. They're doing 6 monthly releases rather than once every 3 or 4 years. So, you know, the pace of improvements can be a lot faster now.
Yeah, I was looking at the other day the Graal VM as well that they've been working on. Looks very interesting. Yeah. Very, especially very cool. When you put something like JRuby on top of it and basically can provide massive speed boosts to other languages by removing, I think it allows you to compile C code into JVM bytecode, a kind of on demand, which then removes the translation.
Compiling it.
Yeah. So then you don't have the translation cost of jumping between your preferred language and C to do the heavy lifting. So it just ends up, for any time that you want to call out to C libraries, being considerably faster. And Ruby being written in C was like, oh, wow, we removed the barrier between the libraries in Ruby that are written in Ruby and the low-level libraries, or the low-level internals in Ruby written in C, because they all end up being one and the same.
Yeah, and the really cool thing about that kind of project is that that's using, I might be getting the names wrong, but I think that's using Truffle, which is kind of a language writing toolkit. So it's not just for C. You could write, I think someone's written an R, this is experimental, but an R compiler interpreter, and you could write sort of arbitrary language runtimes that run on top of the JVM. So, you know, it's has a very, very large scope that, you know, you could imagine, you know, the languages of the future being written on running on the JVM, but implemented through this Truffle or something.
Yeah, Truffle is the thing that someone is, or a number of people are working on for the Ruby community specifically. I'll get a link added to the show notes for that because it's really interesting, although it doesn't really have anything to do with packaging. One other thing that, talking of different kinds of runtimes, that springs to mind is ClojureScript.
Yeah, so ClojureScript is an implementation of Clojure, or a language variant or part of the language family, but it's not kind of strictly the same. And it's written to target the JavaScript runtime, which targets the browser, but also Node.js. People use ClojureScript to talk to. So ClojureScript is sort of in a very interesting position dependency-wise, because it kind of has one foot in NPM land and JavaScript dependencies and one foot in Clojure land with Clojure dependencies. Historically, it's been much more both feet in Clojure land and just a toe in the JavaScript ecosystem. And that's because the way ClojureScript is compiled is that there's a compiler that produces JavaScript from the Clojure, and then, you know, that would be horrendously inefficient and large if you were to just kind of spit that transpiled Clojure, you know, JavaScript into the browser. And so it's run through the Google Clojure compiler, which is Clojure with an S, not with a J, which gets very confusing when you're talking about it. And so the Google Clojure compiler minifies and optimizes the code very heavily, so you can get, you know, pretty small compiled JavaScript and get a lot of mileage out of the Google Clojure libraries. But the tricky part of that is that the Google Clojure compiler kind of only really works on a optimized subset of JavaScript. You know, think of it, JavaScript, the good parts, if you like, that there's certain things you can do with JavaScript that the Clojure compiler just isn't able to analyze and understand. So probably the biggest one is string keys on objects. If you know, in JavaScript, you can call an accessor with a string key, or you can call it, you know, on the field. And the Clojure compiler tries to rename all of the fields into short, you know, one or two letter names to make the package size smaller. But if you've got some things that are dynamically using string keys, then at runtime in your advanced compilation, you'll have half of your code using string keys and half of them using renamed object properties, and that's going to cause a lot of pain. And so that has sort of meant that ClojureScript has not been able to just sort of freely interoperate with kind of every, you know, the vast amount of packages on NPM. And so there's ways that you can tell the Clojure compiler, hey, leave this part alone, don't rename it, but that needs to be done, you know, manually, and most JavaScript packages won't have these, they're called externs. Most JavaScript packages won't have them because most people don't use the Clojure compiler in JavaScript. But there's been recent work in Clojure to be able to more easily make use of NPM packages, which is really cool.
I guess most people who are publishing Node modules aren't necessarily aware that their code could be used as part of a ClojureScript application either, so aren't going to be actively testing against that.
No. And they probably, you know, quite reasonably wouldn't even care if we said they were using it, because, you know, ClojureScript's just such a small, you know, little smidgen of people, you know, 10 or 20,000, probably more like 5 or 10,000 for ClojureScript against, you know, the millions of JavaScript programmers. So, you know, we're pretty small fish in a big pond there.
I was sitting here trying to figure out how this would all work together, and to be honest, my brain hurts, but I want to ask a couple of fundamental questions that maybe I should already understand. When you are distributing a Clojure package, that code, that thing that you are distributing, your package, is a compiled object. I'm imagining it's going to be some kind of Java bytecode, but is that correct, or is it source code that gets distributed in those packages?
It's source code. For the most part, Clojure projects, Clojure and ClojureScript projects are both distributed as, you know, the source code, the files that you are editing. When you package them up into a jar, they will just be copied as is, and, you know, put into a jar and sent to Clojures. And that's one of the reasons why Clojures repository is so small, because we're just dealing with text files that compress relatively well.
Is that true for Maven as well? I thought that with Java you could have binary packages.
That's correct, yeah. So for Maven and in Java land, there is an explicit compilation step where your Java code is compiled into Java bytecode, and then that's the bytecode is what is published to the Maven repository. And the sources are sometimes published as, you know, sort of supplemental jars for your editor to download them. But when you are running a Java package, what your JVM is getting is the compiled code. And so that's kind of because of the way Clojure works with its lispy nature, where it kind of compiles things on the fly. There is kind of an exception to that where you can, it's called AOT compiling. So in the Clojure ecosystem, that means that you sort of run the Clojure compiler on your code before you publish it. And that's usually a very bad idea because it leads to all sorts of weird conflicts down the line with different versions of Clojure or other very strange errors. So I would say, you know, just about never use AOT compilation because it has always bit me eventually.
I'm guessing AOT is ahead of time.
Yes, ahead of time.
Cool. Compiling. And so I'm starting to feel more like some of these individual strands that were, you know, all apart are starting to be like woven together. I guess I should be thinking of Clojure more as an interpreted language, even if it does do this compilation, just-in-time compilation kind of thing, because that makes a lot more sense in a world where code is data.
Yeah, that's the way that, you know, generally you would think of and work with your Clojure code is it's, you know, JIT compiled just in time, and you know all of the sources, the way that people kind of share code is source based.
When you're publishing a Clojure package, do you have the ability to define which versions of Clojure it works with and which ones it doesn't?
Yeah, that's a good question. So Maven and the Maven community and Clojure tend not to use version ranges, and so rather you would put in an explicit version number and only one version number that you support, and then when your project CLJ is resolved by Linogen, it will look at all of your dependencies and your dependencies and try and resolve some compatible set of dependencies that kind of meet all of the constraints that all of your packages ask for. But because they're not using version ranges, the version that you get will usually be at least as new as the one you specify, but it may be newer. And so this is kind of a difference between something like Ruby or Rust, where they have lock files, where you kind of explicitly pin the versions and you can kind of look in a file and just see all of the different versions that are bound there. Because you don't have version ranges, that you don't necessarily need to pin the projects because it's always going to be reproducible. You know, when you run that version resolution algorithm, whenever you run it, you'll always get the same results because it's not depending on any kind of sliding state or sliding version ranges.
It looks like, and I still need to read into this a little bit more, but it looks like the Go community is moving in that kind of direction as well with their VGo new kind of approach to package management that has been proposed, where you would have you would define what your minimum version number is, and then it would do kind of a reverse resolution so that you would not get that like, oh, we can't reproduce the same set of dependencies without a record of what we did last time. I guess that is kind of assuming that people follow Simver and announce their breaking changes in a way that the package manager can understand and go like, I need to avoid that. But you're also, I guess, deploying as jar files to production, which means you're not going to have every machine try and actually download all the dependencies repeatedly, right? So most people aren't going to feel any pain of very subtle differences happening as part of their production deployment because they have a build server, and that once that's done, then the dependencies are kind of frozen until the next time the build server runs.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I'd say that's kind of a good practice in general to have your builds be reproducible. But even if you did kind of at runtime or at, you know, production time when you started your project, you wanted to download all of the jar files, that would still be reproducible. That would be the same as what you got on your development machine, you know, as long as you had the same project file, because there's no version ranges there.
So does that mean that when a security fix needs to go out in a deeply nested dependency that you have to reach out to everyone that depends on that thing to get them to update the version that they're depending on as well, and kind of move the whole community forwards to make sure that that old insecure version is no longer being used.
Sort of. The way that Linogan works is that if you have an explicit dependency at the top level that you kind of specify, I want this version, that will be the one that is used. So let's say like Struts, Java, Apache Struts was a package that had vulnerabilities last year. And so if you were using Struts and you said, oh no, you know, I've got these five different projects that are all using this old version of Struts and I'm, you know, it's vulnerable, you could in your own project file say, I want to use, you know, the new version of Struts, and that will be the one that's picked. But you do kind of get this, that there may be packages, if you've only got one source of a particular jar dependency coming in through your nested dependencies, that's never going to be updated until that package updates it, or you do so yourself.
So you can kind of drag that transitive dependency up to the top level and declare it in your project.
That's right.
Yes. Even if the transitive project that pulled it in said, I need version 1, you can say, actually, I need version 1.1 because it's got these security fixes in.
Yeah.
And I'm going to assume that you'll be all right with that. Like, the API probably will be fine.
Yeah. And the other thing that you can do is you can set exclusions on a dependency. So this is pretty common. If you've got more than one dependency that uses Netty, Netty's a, you know, very popular Java project for HTTP clients and servers, and you know, sometimes there's, because it's, you know, bytecode compiled ahead of time, sometimes there's, you know, there's breaking changes in the compilation, you know, things are moved around or method signatures are no longer the same, and so you want to be quite explicit usually about which version of Netty is being used. So you can set exclusions on your dependencies, so you can say, I want to use CLJ time, but you can say, but don't listen to CLJ time when it tells you what version of Netty you want. You should instead use the one that I tell you about.
Right. So you're very much the kind of the master of your own domain as someone who is managing dependencies in their Clojure projects.
Yes.
Rather than just saying, I'll assume that the maintainer knows what they're doing best, which is usually what happens in the Ruby or the JavaScript community, is the management of transitive dependencies is almost entirely kind of just outsourced to the maintainers of each project.
Yeah, and that's and one of the reasons why that works okay in Clojure and in the Java community is that the depth of package dependencies is usually not that deep. You know, it would be, you know, whereas in JavaScript it might not be unusual to have, I don't know, 20 levels deep. You know, it would be unusual in a Clojure package to see something more than sort of 5 or 8 levels deep. And usually you tend to have a fewer number of dependencies in your project as well. So there's definitely some benefits I can see to something like NPM's approach of, you know, transitive, you know, version ranges, which might become more necessary as you have, you know, just much deeper, wider dependency trees.
I did go poking around inside of Maven and found they do have the ability to do some kind of version range, but it's not like a version range you would recognize from the kind of Semver world. It is essentially mathematical notation for ranges, and reads very strangely. I tried to write a converter between the mathematical notation for a range and a Semver range. It didn't go particularly well, but as a way of trying to show, oh, that like this weird edge case does allow for this version or this version or this version, rather than saying like the something around the patch level of 1.1.x, which there's no concept of that in Maven as far as I could see.
So one thing that's been changing in the Clojure community recently is that there's a new tool from the Clojure core team, which is a different way of building and running and managing your Clojure programs. And one thing that's really nice about it is that the dependency file is not executable code, but it's a static file. It's in the format called Eden, which is sort of Clojure's, you can think of it as JSON for Clojure, essentially. And so this Eden file is going to be much easier to do anything with, because it's just, you know, this static file that you can read and understand without having to execute any code. And probably the most, I would say, controversial, but one of the choices they've made is that they've added the ability for people to specify Git dependencies in their Clojure programs. And this is possible because, as we were talking about before, Clojure is not compiled when it's deployed. So you could, you know, just say, give me this particular bunch of files and, you know, start working with them. And so the main reason why historically Clojure has used jars is not because they were strictly needed for working with Clojure, but, you know, because that's the way the rest of the Maven ecosystem worked. And so I'm kind of probably one of the most biased people you could ask about this, because, you know, I run Clojars, which is, you know, in some sense a in competition to using Git as dependencies. But I think there's some pretty big risks and problems with using Git as a, or GitHub as a kind of source for your dependencies.
Yeah, I when I saw this, and I saw a little bit of drama on Twitter, but kind of just ignored it. But my initial reaction, without really using it or having any skin in the game, was, which is the best way to have a reaction on the internet, is that you're going to pick up a number of the kind of problems that the Go community have been running into recently. The most recent one that I saw was someone deleted their GitHub account and they had a fairly popular Go project. Someone else then signed up a GitHub account of the same name, created a repo of the same name as well, and put another Go project in there, which actually appears to have been the same project, but there's the opportunity to completely, like, screw over the users of that particular thing, because next time you run Go get, it's just gonna go, ah, this is the same, this URL continues to resolve to a project that I was expecting to be there. It just so happens what you download may not be what you were expecting to get.
Yeah, so that's probably, you know, the most obvious thing that first comes to mind is, you know, what happens when something changes, because GitHub is not, you know, in contrast to say Clojars or Maven Central, you have full control over your own repositories on GitHub. You can delete them, you can rebase them, you can kind of do whatever you like, and there's nothing stopping anybody from just deleting their projects when they, you know, quit the internet. The Clojure tools do have one kind of thing to stop this being quite as bad as the Go get version, which is that you need to specify a SHA, that, you know, the commit that you're referencing. And so if that commit isn't there, then you'll at least get an error. But in theory, using kind of GitHub or Git repositories is a great idea, because they're sort of fully reproducible. You can just sort of specify the SHA and it's, you know, no one can kind of swap that out from underneath you. You know that that's always going to be what it resolves to. But in practice, I suspect that that might be troublesome for projects that kind of go down that path, because, you know, people don't treat GitHub as kind of an immutable, a crate-only place, because they haven't had to up until now.
So maybe this is a good point to talk a little bit about dApps. So we're talking about various ecosystems and repos. dApps is a private Maven repository service that you're building. Tell us a bit more about that.
Sure. So I've worked in a few different places that use Clojure or Java. And, you know, if you're in a team of any kind of size, you generally have private dependencies that you want to work with that you don't necessarily want to share, you know, on Clojars or Maven Central. And so you need some place to put them. And so the way you tend to do that is you run a Maven repository that your internal projects can all talk to download the different dependencies that they need. And the existing tools that you might use, Artifactory and Nexus, are very rich tools and they have a lot of features. But for smaller companies, there can be too many features. It can be a little bit too complicated to use them. And Artifactory and Nexus both were kind of born in the on-premise software era. Artifactory does have a hosted solution, but it's relatively expensive to run because I think they run a virtual machine for you when you use that. And so I could see that, you know, in my own work, I wanted a Maven repository that was hosted, simple to use, and didn't kind of require me to spend a lot of time figuring it out or maintaining it or setting it up. And so I couldn't find anything like that, and so I created Deps.
And has anything surprised you about being in this world now? Things that you never thought about private repositories before you had to run one yourself?
Not really. I mean, running Clojars gave me quite a lot of experience with what's involved with the Maven repository and how it works and what's needed there. And so there's still, you know, similar access controls, but, you know, one more layer of read-only, you know, read access controls as well as write access controls.
Wow, I was just looking at the pricing for Artifactory and it kind of blew my mind. It was just like, what? People pay this much for this? Sorry, completely off topic.
I know, how much does Artifactory cost?
The base for on-prem is $3,000 a year, going up to $30,000 per year for the enterprise universal Artifactory repository with high availability and multi-site replications. Whereas Deps.co is only $49 a month. That sounds very reasonable. How can you afford to compete with a company with so much resources behind it?
So because Deps is written to be run as a multi-tenant service, you know, I can afford to run, you know, I don't have to run one VM per customer, which means that, you know, it's much more affordable to run. And, you know, I don't have, and I probably will never have as many, you know, enterprise features as something like Artifactory, you know, just because, you know, as you say, they've got massive amounts of resources that that I'll never have. But, you know, the core of the problem that, you know, probably 50, 60, 80% of people need is to be able to store and retrieve their private artifacts from somewhere in the cloud.
And that looks like you're just kind of in the beta stage at the moment. So I guess you've got a few people trying it out and you're kind of working out how best to start to scale that out.
Yeah, I've got people using it now, and you know, anybody can put in their email on deps.co and, you know, I'll be in touch pretty quickly to help you get signed up. Really the last thing that I need to do before it gets published is there's a little bit of admin controls and onboarding for people to use. But the repository itself has been running great for 6 months or more now.
Well, best of luck with launching Deps and getting that out of beta and into production. If people were interested in taking a look at Clojure for the first time, where should they start for that?
There's a guide on the Clojure website, clojure.org, and you can go there and go through a quick start there. There's also a really great sort of guide introduction to the Clojure language called Clojure for the Brave and True, which is sort of has some humor and stuff injected in there. Those are probably two pretty good ways to get started.
And if people wanted to get involved in the Clojars project and helping out with that, where should they go to find out more about that?
They can go to github.com/Clojars and you can see the different projects we have there and start picking up some issues off the issue tracker if you'd like to help.
And I guess finally, where should people go to learn more about you and your work?
My personal website is danielcompton.net. And Deps is at deps.co.
Awesome. Well, this has been really interesting. Thanks so much for shining a light on the Clojure world and its relationship with Maven, Maven Central, and also kind of schooling us on some of the internals of Maven as well. Good luck with launching deps.co, and hopefully we'll have you back on soon.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.